Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 102. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in, guys. And thank you. I mean, having you all tune in this week means all the more because it means that the four drunk episodes haven't put you off too much. Because damn, they got messy. Good Lord. Good googly moogly, they got messy. But thank you for tuning in, guys. As ever, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Come check us out. You can go there and support the podcast. And I mention this, and people, you hear it every week, so you don't really care. But it's a good way to just give some money back for the free episodes that you get every week. We've done over 100 now. This is episode 102, but a lot of them have been in multiple parts. So you can buy Team 3W mugs, which is the welcome distraction pieces to Team 3W, the hardcore, and t-shirts and all sorts. But you can also get our new stickers at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. It's a great sticker pack. It's got some speech development stickers, some Scroobius Pip stickers, a Team 3W sticker. So it's a real variation. Check that out. Also, they're free if you're spending over £30 in the store. So that's super lovely too. Let me tell you some tour date announcement stuff, because I might have announced it online by now. I'm recording this a couple of weeks in advance. Have I mentioned that my guest is Colin Murray? He's great. It's a two-parter. You're going to love it. But let me mention some tour date stuff, because I'm not going to have exact details for you, but I'll talk you through it all because it's very exciting. I've got my book coming out. It's the Distraction Pieces podcast book, and I'm releasing it on my birthday, August 3rd, and I'm doing a special live launch book launch / birthday podcast at the Leicester Square Theatre, which is where we did the last live one, and I'd love for you guys to come along to that. I'm going to be recording it, but yeah, I'd love you all to come along. The setup for the live podcast is that I'm just going to have you guys come up and be part of the podcast, so I'm going to get you to form an orderly queue and come on and ask a question, and we'll have a bit of a chat on a subject, and that's going to make up the podcast. We've got a few people coming along who are previous Distraction Pieces guests who are also going to hopefully get up and get involved. But yeah, that's how the big Leicester Square one's going to work. But then I'm doing a book tour, and it's weird because the book is a book of the podcast. And although I've talked about it loads, and I'll talk about it more on that live book launch one, although I've written extra stuff and extra sections and new bits, it's a weird one to do readings. And they asked if I'd do sign-ins, and it's like I'm not Katie Price. It's a bit odd. So I decided to do these mini live podcasts all around the country, and I'm not going to record all of them. In fact, most of them I'm not going to record. It's just going to be in the moment. But it's basically a way to come to bookstores or venues and do a book launch and sign-in, but also have something more there. So again, it'll be the same thing. You can come up on stage, ask me a question, and we'll have a discussion on the topic. If anyone turns up, if it's just you and me, then we'll just, you know, have a chat, and it will last 10 minutes, and then we can all go home. But yeah, so on the 4th of August, I'm going to be in Birmingham. On the 5th of August, I'm going to be in Manchester. On the 6th of August, I'm going to be in Edinburgh. Now, we're going to hopefully record that one, because it's part of the Edinburgh Fringe. Tickets are on sale now. They might have already sold out. They're going very quick. It's a small venue. So yeah, that's happening there. On the 8th of August, I'm going to be in Glasgow. Also hoping to record that one because it's at the Oran Moor, which is a venue I've been to in the past and loved. I think that's where it is anyway. I might have made that up. But yeah, the Glasgow one, tickets again are on sale now, and that's a bigger venue, so please spread the word on that, because we hope to get some people through, despite the fact Edinburgh Festival will be on and everyone will be in Edinburgh. On the 9th, on Tuesday the 9th of August, I'll be in Liverpool. On Wednesday the 10th, I'll be in Bristol. On Wednesday the 10th, I'll be in Bristol. On Thursday the 11th, we're trying to sort either Cardiff or Brighton, and we're trying to make one work and see what we can fit in, because we're not sure how much we can fit in. But on Friday the 12th is the exciting one. I'm going to be in Stamford Le Hope, in Stamford Library, which I've lived in Stamford my whole life. And my mum worked in that library and runs that library. And my brother has worked in that library. So come along to that. Yeah, I'm excited about that. All of these you can get tickets for online in advance. The ones that aren't proper live ones are obviously a lot cheaper tickets, because it's more a sign-in and blah, blah, blah. But the ones that are recorded, bigger ones, they're a bit more expensive because they're venues and there's crew and staff to take into account and recording and all that kind of thing. But yeah, so come along to them. I'd love the Stanford one to get nice and busy. But I said, all of these tickets are available. Just do a bit of Googling and that. They're going to be pretty easy to find. You've got the date, the location, and you know my name. If you Google my name, the location, and the date, you're sure to figure it out. So that's that. I'm going to get on with this podcast now because this has now become a long intro. I had Colin Murray on, and I love Colin Murray. This is one of the most I've looked forward to. We've been trying to get this in for a while, and a lot of you will be already familiar with Colin from his great Radio 1 show, from his great Talk Sports show, from all his TV he's done and everything else. But he gave me and Dan one of my favourite interviews that we had in our career, and it was great fun and just always got on with him ever since. He also gave me a spoken word section on his BBC One show, which is... Or BBC Radio 1 show, sorry, which is crazy, particularly at the time. There wasn't any spoken word getting on big radio stations, so it meant a lot. Obviously, this turned into a two-parter because we had a lot to catch up on and reminisce, and he's a great talker. He tells some wonderful stories. So I normally do these as a midnight and midday. Shall I do that this time? Yeah, I will. I'll do it as midnight and midday because it just works better. So this one will already have gone up at midnight because you're listening to it now. At midday, part two will be out as well. So check that out. I'm going to not ramble on too much more. This is Colin Murray on the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to the Distraction. She did Adam Buxton and she did my podcast. So then she said, I've come into the press enough now. I'm just going to ease off
again. And that's it.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was Kathy Burke. I'm joined by Colin Murray. How are you, sir?
Yes, good. Nice to see you. We go back.
We do go back. But, yeah. I've been really looking forward to this one because I say this on the podcast every now and then. And I said it's exciting to do people like Kathy Burke and Adam Buxton, who I've been a fan of but not met. But it's equally exciting people that I go way back with, but we never get a chance to catch up and never get a chance to chat. So,
and also shoe on the other foot.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've probably interviewed you 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
So, and payback.
I think possibly, definitely top 5, but possibly my most enjoyable interview was on your show.
Oh, fantastic. On Radio 1.
On Radio 1. When me and Dan came in, and I can't even remember what we talked about, but all three of us were literally in tears at one point.
Yeah.
And it was just, it works.
Well, that's so nice. That's really nice coming from you because, you know, when I listen to your podcast as well, You talk to the person as an equal, and it sounds like an arrogant thing to say, but it's always been a thing for me when I'm interviewing people is you know, treat them as an equal because that's the most respectful you can be. You know, if you think you're better than them when you're interviewing, I'm the journalist and I'm going to interview you and I demean anything about what you do, then you really shouldn't be doing an interview. But similarly, if you put them on a pedestal, they will go into autopilot so quickly because they're like, fuck, I've answered this like 40 times today. And it's not being different for the sake of it. It's just, my first ever interview, proper sort of face-to-face was, and this show's fucking on 40 next year, it was the launch of Pepsi Blue. Do you remember when Pepsi Blue came out the can? It used to be red, white and blue. Do you remember?
Spice Girls kind of era.
It was kind of, they launched it by painting Concord Blue at Heathrow. And I worked for a local newspaper, I was 16 or whatever. So because I've been doing quite a decent job as a work experience, they give me that as a free trip. So I flew from Belfast into Heathrow and interviewed the people who were launching it, which was somebody else, might have been like Boris Becker or something, I can't remember. Yeah. And then it was Claudia Schiffer and Cindy Crawford. And Cindy Crawford had been my sort of 13-year-old sort of teenage crush. Yeah. So I had posters of her on the wall and stuff like that, you know. And I went to interview her at 16. And I don't mean it's in a disparaging way, but when she sat down, she wasn't any prettier than the girl who I was dating back home.
It
taught me about this horrible aesthetic. In my very first interview, I learned about the horrible aesthetic of celebrity because here was the girl who was on my wall and, you know, filled me full of very naughty thoughts and private moments who didn't even fancy her as a, you know, as a horny teenager sitting beside me. And it kind of from then realized, it really smashed preconceptions early on. I've always thought that's a, so from then, I've always tried to interview people with that in mind, and that we're all exactly the same. And, you know, I should give you the equal amount of respect that I expect from you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, as humans, 100%. And it's what's greatly misinterpreted about the whole Just a Band section of Thou Shalt. Is it saying exactly that? It's saying, these are just people.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because they're posters on your wall, they're this and that. But in reality, they're just a bunch of dudes.
And you know? People, if you go through that list, people always have fantastic stories about moments that backs that up. And, you know, say the Pixies. A friend of mine picked up Black Francis from the airport to take him to a festival in Ireland. And then the whole drive, the whole way there, he was telling him about some sort of breakdown in his personal life. And he's in the car and he's just thinking, fucking hell, don't do this. It's like, mental. To me, you're like the ultimate human legend. And I'm like, no, that's brilliant, you know. That's, we all bleed exactly the same, you know. And I think if once you put yourself there, you know, there's a real misconception that the good interviews are the ones where you're stern-faced and you're pushing people. And I've always hated that, you know, I've always hated that. And sometimes a lot to the consternation of my bosses, you know, I won't ask that question that gets that news line because I just feel like, well, I know what you're going to say when I ask that, and you know.
It's so weird that the podcast, like when I started this, it started to get a lot of love, and what it seemed to be because of was kind of exactly that, which should be the standard, but it's the fact that
it's not.
We have relaxing conversations with people I want to talk to. I have people ask me all the time if I'd have a Tory MP on and things like that. It's like, I wouldn't because I'm not into them, but I don't do the podcast to dig anyone out or attack anyone. I'm not an investigative journalist. These are meant to be enjoyable conversations. And if there's a big topic that needs to come up, I'll try and bring it up. But in a way you would with mates. I remember when it was actually after the podcast, but I had Ricky Hall on.
Yeah.
And after that, he had his big thing. He was in, he's a model, and he had this big thing in the paper where they were just saying he's Zoolander. He's the biggest idiot in the world. He had this quote in the paper that said, they said, oh, where do you take your style influence from? And he said, anywhere from children to the catwalk to homeless people.
Yeah.
And the fact he said homeless people got people a lot of shit. And he texts me the next day saying, because he's meant to be DJing at my club, and he's like, just still want me to DJ because it's not going down well. I said, no, it's fine. You're all right. But then I also said, you know you fucked up with that line, though. Because in reality, you would talk about them things, but not in a attacking, why did you say this? What was that about?
That world of where he's, you know, who printed that.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it's diminishing hugely now, which I love.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's certain newspapers, one in particular that we all know.
Yeah.
Its only consistency is in printing lies and losing readers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dropped by like 300,000 a year every year for like 10 years, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
And they recently printed something about my private life, and I said to everyone involved, I said, look, don't even give them a no comment. Act like it doesn't exist, because they don't. You know, we can't let these people govern our lives, and they don't have that power anymore anyway.
Yeah.
And funny enough, I got one tweet about it. You know, if I tweeted out, I've just seen Magpie taking a shit in a train station, I'd get more than one tweet back, you know?
Yeah.
And it's great to see that diminish in that world. And I think a lot of famous people answer them and treat them like real human beings that got oppressed. And you just don't have to. You just block them out of your life now. And that's fantastic, you know?
I think we've learned a lesson about the gutter press from trolls and social media.
Yeah.
Is you realise that the more you respond to them, the more they grow.
Absolutely.
The more you go, who gives a shit what this?
Yeah.
Like, everyone knows what you print is nonsense.
Yeah.
Why would I even engage
in it? And we also know that they fake pictures, that they hack dead girls' phones, and they do some of the most heinous things you could ever imagine. So, and we are, the great thing about the technology and the digital revolution, if you like, is that I think we're all, and I include myself in this, much more savvy about how things work.
Yeah.
And we demand a little bit more, I think, you know, and that's a good thing. It's interesting you say about the whole interview thing as well. I learned I'm always learning, you know, I'm always trying to learn a little bit more. And it was only about, how many years ago now? 5.5 years ago, I was making an Olympic documentary, a big Olympic documentary. And I was trying to track down every living British Olympic gold medalist. It was 114.
Wow.
So I tracked down 113 in the end. But the guy I was working with stopped me after about 5, 6, 7 interviews. And he said, do you know the one thing you're not doing? I was like, what? And he went, you don't watch back the footage. You read so much. You read 20 interviews and you read them, but you don't watch the thing. Yeah. So we're interviewing Adrian Merhouse, and he said, watch it back and have a look. So I watched him win the race, and he said, what did you get out of it? And I was like, well, he was wearing a white T-shirt, and nobody else was when they walked out. They were all bare-chested, and he was wearing a white T-shirt. And he went, right, ask him about it then. So I thought, well, I'm going to ask him about that. So in the interview, I said, I noticed you're wearing a white T-shirt. And he went, oh, no, there was no reason for that. I was like, so it wasn't a lucky thing. And he was like, no. And he went, you know what, though? I did have lucky speedos up until like a month before that, and I lost. And in a fit of rage, I cut them up, like with all the pressure of the Olympics had got. And all of a sudden it led to this fantastic story, which eventually led to a story about him meeting David Wilkie when he was a kid and saying to David Wilkie, who was an Olympic gold medalist, I want to be an Olympic gold medalist. So like sometimes the most small things, I mean, you shy. And so I've learned, you know, I think you're always learning. But ultimately, as I begin this interview with a huge ramble, if I was you right now, I'd be thinking, shut the fuck up.
Oh, I love it.
And this is where radio works, and I would count this as radio, if you like.
Yeah, sure.
Is that that's exactly what you've got time to do, you know?
Yeah, you can have and these long...
Yeah, you can find a lot more about the person, you know?
It's fascinating. I was obsessed for a while with every time people talk about X Factor or The Voice or any of these, and how they're these flash-in-the-pan moments, they're famous and then they're gone. It always struck me that... And how harsh that is. It always struck me that, well, the Olympics is a million times worse than that, because you spend years training for this and then the day later, everyone's forgotten.
Well, and this is double cruel because I can't remember a name, which makes me a horrible person because the story is about how people can't remember a name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there was two Olympics in a row. A female yachting trio won gold and they were called the Blondes in a Boat.
Yeah.
And after the first time, there was a fallout and one was replaced by another one. And it was this young girl. She went with the two better known sailors, won Olympic gold, and then went back to university. So she would be, I would say, amongst the most unknown Olympic gold medalist Britain has ever produced. Anyway, and I feel terrible for not remembering her name. She goes back to university and she's studying sports science and all that stuff. And in the class, they do a thing in class. What attributes do you need to be an Olympic gold medalist? And she hasn't told anyone in the class that she's won Olympic gold. So she fills out, she does the thing, and she comes bottom of the class. And the teacher points it out and says, so you would you absolutely don't have what it takes to be an Olympic gold medalist. Meanwhile, she is a fucking Olympic gold medalist.
That's so mental, isn't it?
You know, always love that story.
That's crazy.
But that kind of does sum up the sort of oblivion that you can go to.
But it's the realisation as well. And I think, I can't remember who I was talking to on the podcast. It was during the podcast I kind of realised this, that the only problem with that is our obsession with celebrity.
Yeah, exactly.
The fact is, the people who are spending all their years to get this insane level of fitness or athleticism or skill, they're not doing that to be famous.
Absolutely.
They're doing that to achieve that. I got really angry a while back. You see it posted a lot, and by people who would be into my stuff and follow me, people post a meme saying, stop making stupid people famous.
Yeah.
And it annoys me, because it's like, right, well, number one, intelligence doesn't have to be the only thing of fame. And number two, most of the intelligent people in the world probably aren't looking to be famous and probably don't give a shit about fame. They've got far more important things to worry about. So on both sides of it, it's like there's an ignorance there in that statement, in trying to be elitist about intelligence and saying all these stupid celebrities. It's like celebrities, part of that is for the stupid stuff in life, the ludicrousness in life.
A lot of intelligent people are as fame hungry as somebody who would consider to be not as academical, and the world's full of so-called reputable journalists and less reputable journalists who are no different to me than a 16-year-old with a guitar who turns up at X Factor and will do anything to be famous.
Yeah.
They're no different.
Yeah.
You know, and I almost won't name them, not because I'm afraid of naming them, because I just don't think they ever deserve to be mentioned. But we know the journalists we're talking about. You know, one in particular who will say anything controversial. You know, his Twitter feed at the moment's trying to barb people a little bit about Muhammad Ali, who just passed away as we're recording this.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, you're no different than... Yeah. A 16-year-old guy or a 16-year-old girl who can't really sing very well, but will do anything to be in that boy band or that girl band. That's you. Yeah. And just because you're wearing a suit doesn't make it any different. Just because you got a degree doesn't make it any different.
Completely.
You're solely insecure and need fame to validate your existence. And there's journalists that are no different than pop singers.
make it stop making horrible people famous,
yeah,
or nasty people famous. That's a far better, because again, it's not about intelligence. You can be the most intelligent guy in the world and you can be a piece of shit.
Exactly. And my philosophy is that fame doesn't exist. You know, it's really interesting. I mean, it's happened so many times in my life, and I think, how has this person changed? You know, and the only thing that's changed them is that they get stuck in the bubble. And Ronnie Barker lived, I lived just outside London, and Ronnie Barker used to live in this village I live in, and he ran I think his wife ran the actual antique shop, but he would often be out the back pottering away. And he's got a great quote, and it's always stuck with me. It's in my like top five mantras I always remember if I ever turn into a prick, you know.
I always think,
well, what are you doing? Get back to where you are.
Yeah.
And you know, I've had moments in my life where I've done certain jobs where you feel yourself getting sucked into it a bit. And someone said to him, Ronnie, what's it like being the most recognisable person in Britain? Which Ronnie Barker probably would be right up there on the list when he was alive. He would have been his whole life.
Yeah.
You know, the rimmed glasses, and you know, you straight away know it's him.
Completely.
And he said, fame is somebody who doesn't get the bus. That's what famous is. Yeah. When you decide yourself that you will no longer get on the bus, you've made yourself famous.
Yeah.
You put yourself behind the rope, is what he was saying. And it's true, like, the more Ronnie Barker got on the bus just outside Harrow, the less people gave a fuck that Ronnie Barker was on the bus.
Yeah.
And what a privilege it is, and I am, you know, absolutely minor in this front, you know, in terms of people recognise who I am. But, you know, usually once a day someone goes to me, hey, you, well, what privilege that is. And I don't have the social barrier when I pay for petrol. Usually the guy, because he's got the radio on 12 hours a day, goes, I'll listen to a show. And
of course.
We do a thing on my radio show where someone phoned up one of the very first ones in Talk Sport and said, great show, and I can't stand people. I like the people. I hate average that, show. You know. So I was like, average, it's average. And it's stuck for 3 years. But it's become like a code for people who are coming up to me not to ask me what Gary Lineker was like when I did Match of the Day. They want to come up and just say, I'm part of your connection and your community. And they'll always go, all right, mate, average show. They'll go, average sunglasses you're wearing, or average jeans.
Brilliant.
And it never gets tired. I never get tired of it, because that's the privilege of doing anything that's in the public eye.
Yeah.
Not everybody creates the rest of themselves. There are exceptions, and I understand what it must be like to walk down a street if you're Paul McCartney, who was exposed to an era where he wouldn't have been aware of what was going to come and what trappings would come with it.
We had one of the first media. True eras of fame, which is an interesting thing actually to come up, as you mentioned, the greatest, Muhammad Ali passing, or yesterday as we talk about this now, right? It's a fascinating thing, because people are talking a lot about 2016 being a crazy year for people dying. But
is it just we're old? We're getting older?
It's the era of celebrity.
Yeah.
We're now 50 to 60 years from when TV and music and everything blew up. The amount of celebrities that before then, before McCartney and things like that, there weren't that many super famous people.
Yeah.
And after that, there was a lot more. So you think of what age he's at. He's at that age where a lot of his peers are going to be passing away. Yeah. So the thinking on my part is that 2016 feels unusual now. That's going to be the norm.
Yeah.
Because we've reached that point where all the boom in celebrity has they've all got older now.
I'm going to have to get my head around and accept it, because there was a run for a while where it felt like every week I was going on the radio and just feeling so deflated. And, you know, we were doing a sports show where we're like, you know, let's just leave sport for a bit, you know. And the worst thing about, the worst one was Prince, because I've never seen Prince live. There's some artists that you haven't seen, and they're on the list, and various things happen to stop you seeing them.
Yeah.
And I like baseball, and I was watching baseball in the States. And my partner rang me and said, you'll never guess what, Prince has just confirmed two shows at the Roundhouse tomorrow night and the night after, and the tickets went on sale this morning, and I've got to. And I was like, oh, fuck, I might fly back, and I didn't. And I would have been crazy to fly back. I literally just landed, but I was that keen.
Yeah.
And fuck, I didn't. That was last year.
Yeah.
So another one, Neil Young, I've had tickets and not seen him, and I've got tickets to see him in Lyon next week.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, don't let anything happen, you know?
You go, because again, I had similar. I had tickets when me and Dan blew up with our first single and got our first big tour, I had tickets to see Prince doing his run at the O2. No. And it was like, we've got our first headline tour, I can't. And two different times I had tickets. I did catch him in the end at Hop Farm Festival. Nice. And just amazing. But I think
that whole thing, as you were saying there, that it's a weird thing, particularly being a public figure in any way or having any kind of show where if someone dies, you kind of have to address it. It's that odd thing on social media, and if you do or you don't, I'm now of the thinking of, I'd rather text my mates about it and say, man, this is so sad, rather than make a public thing. But if you're on a radio show, it's hard not to. But I think the positive that's going to come from this is, and it sounds weird that a positive is going to come from the point in time coming when more celebrities are dying, but I think it's going to make people more comfortable with the idea of death, which they should be. Because the fact is, the more this becomes normal, the less it's going to be this big shock and big weird thing, because every month there's going to be someone that means a lot to you musically, in sport, in film, that passes away, and you're going to have to kind of come to terms with the fact that everyone dies. That's a good thing, I think.
I would disagree. I would say that it will be an eternal problem, people coming to terms with death. And I don't think anything's going to change that. My brothers, we're two very different types of atheists as we get older. I'm a very liberal, passive atheist. You know, I don't in any way feel that somebody who embraces a god is less intelligent. I just believe we're all very complex and we make up our minds. And, you know.
Completely. And
I love having, you know, good debate, especially we've got like three or four religions and non-religions at one poker school, you know, I love having fun with that. And I'm like, do you realise if you're wrong, he's right? And if he's right, you can't be right. I love just having fun with that. I'm different that way. So like a lot of people who I know who don't believe in God will say, well, religion's dying out, but just look at churches and just look at the people who are in churches. And I'm like, that's not the case. As you get older and you're struggling to come to terms with what's next, church is a wonderful bosom to grab onto. It's a wonderful thing to clutch, because it gives you that, I don't believe it, but it does give you that assurance that there's something else.
Yeah.
Whereas I try my best as an adult to live my life that there isn't anything else, and just, you know, try and make sure every night you go to bed after you wake up that you can go, and it ties into what we're saying. You know, at the very least, you haven't been too much of a dickhead, and even better if you've managed to do something that you feel has not given something, not sort of is judged by other people to be good, but by yourself, you can say, I'm glad I've done that today.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult. That's quite a new thing for me to try and do that. And, so it's, I suppose it all sort of ties in that. I don't think anything will ever really
make
human race say, we're okay with death.
I dream of the day they are. Because again, I'm weirdly, again, I mean, a lot of my lyrics discuss death. It's because I'm weirdly kind of okay with it. And I think that came from, like, every time my nan would go on holiday, my mum would get annoyed because my nan would go, well, my will's here and all the details of what to do if I die is here. And my mum would be like, you're going on holiday. Don't prepare us all for you to die. But that was kind of a beautiful thing to me, because it was like that idea of death was like, well, that's going to happen at some point. So here's the practical things you do.
You're born and you die and you'll feel lonely. And there's three or four things in life. I was reading about the givens that, you know, you should never make any decisions based on the fact you were born.
Yeah.
Never make any decisions based on the fact that you're going to die.
It's one of the big beliefs that Prince had. You know, he wasn't into birthdays because he said, well, if we didn't know that we were going to die at some point, you wouldn't celebrate this tick of surviving another year. If we never knew about death, we wouldn't go, that's another year. We've not died yet. He's like, it's all inevitable.
But I call them greetings cards days. I mean, I don't do birthdays. I hate New Year's Eve. And I hate New Year's Eve because I'm just sad. I'm sad at the amount of people who say, tomorrow I'm going to do something. And I'm kind of thinking, you could just do it on November the fucking 17th. It's a Gregorian calendar, you know. So just you decide what you want to do and do it. You know, and I never get that. But the weirdest thing, now I'm going to turn into Victor Meldrew. I have every year I say the same thing to everybody in my family and friends. I'm like, I don't do birthdays. I hate birthdays. Please don't buy me anything. I'm not interested in the cards. They go in the bin, and I'm not being heartless, but it's like, it's just my choice.
I agree on the cards at Christmas as well. I'm very much, why are you all giving us cards?
Oh, I don't get it. I'll say to like my wife, if you want to get me a little thing, that's fine. I'll open it in the morning, great. But I really don't want any parts of it. It's amazing how many people still buy me things after me saying that. And I kind of think, is that selfish of you to buy me a present? Because I've said my perfect birthday is to acknowledge, not acknowledge it.
I was discussing this with someone the other day, bizarrely, and again, it's beautiful to have people that you can have open discussions with and it not be an insult, because a friend of mine was saying that she loves to give presents. And I was like, well, but that is in a way selfish, because if you're giving a present for no reason and that person then feels bad that they've not got a present for you, do you know what I mean? The enjoyment that you're getting from giving that present, they're not getting, because they don't get to give you a present. And it's... There is a weird selfishness there.
More normal people than you and I would say, I give you that fucking present, you ignorant twat, because I really like you and I care for you.
Yeah.
So I like that we've twisted it too, because I agree with you.
Selfish for giving me a present. But yeah,
you selfish bastard. How dare you buy me a present? But the point was, I say I don't want them.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And I think it comes back to not... I don't like to sort of... And listen, this sounds like I'm incredibly rounded, but I'm not. This comes from failures, because I didn't acknowledge this in my earlier years, coming through a broken family into adulthood and making the wrong decisions. Yeah. I learned about these things, and try not to make decisions based on where I was born, how I was born, and how I was brought up. I try not to make decisions based on the fact that I could die. And I try not to, and also, I try not to make decisions because I don't want to be lonely.
Yeah.
And that's the big one.
Yeah,
and I'll always say this to, in the ups and downs of my own relationships and stuff, I always say, look, it's all about wanting to be together, not wanting to not be alone. And a lot of people make decisions based on sort of, well, that means there's somebody there.
Yeah.
And I think that's as dangerous as making it based on the fact, shit, I'm going to die, I need to settle now, and I need to have kids now, something. And I need to see every part of the fucking world, and So it's, but yeah, coming to terms with death, I think I'm okay with it. It's strange, because I remember in a book when I was at school, it said the average age people lived to, and at the time it was 72 for men and 70 for women.
Yeah.
And it's always stuck in my head that I remember thinking that day, I was only about 8 or 9. No, it would have been about 11. And I remember going, 72, that's the ripe old age I'm going to live to. And to this day, I'm pretty sure I'm going to die when I'm 72.
Yeah.
How stupid is that?
Yeah.
Just for a textbook.
You've got that down. That's when it's going to happen. That's
I'll still be thinking. I'll still have the old thought every couple of months. I'll go, how long have I left?
Yeah.
Well, that's not bad, actually. 32 years. Wow.
You see, I'm the opposite. I always look and go, oh, God, that sounds exhausting. I've got at least 30, 40. Oh, man. I mean, I'm tired now. And it's been 34 years. I can't imagine doing all of this again.
But you must be enjoying this part of your life. Yeah, I find this the most enjoyable part of mine.
Yeah.
20s, I'd fucking never live again.
100%. I think right now, and again, all things like fitness, I believe in fitness, not for extending your life, for getting the most enjoyment out of your life now.
Absolutely.
I like being in good shape and being able to do things and not have to worry about
it. And isn't that funny? Because we were a nation of obese, apparently, and we were moving towards this horrible era where everyone was going to have various sugar-related diseases.
Yeah.
And I, more and more, I'm seeing this swell of people who are giving up smoking, are running through parks, are going into affordable gyms. I'm the same. I gave up smoking 18 months ago. I've lost a couple of stone. It's definitely... different on that front now. I think it's much more of a normal part of life, those things.
I'll sound like a cynic, but it's because they found revenues in them.
Oh, absolutely.
It's because the booming gyms, CrossFit or whatever else, or anti-smoking stuff, or all these things. It's like, we can make some money out of this, therefore it can now become a positive for society,
but also
I'm fine with.
The thing that put people's weight on in the first place in terms of the invention of proper computers, not the Spectrum 2Ks, but moving into the PlayStation era, the things that got us fat in the first place are the same things, like this here watch I'm wearing now, is the same thing that's getting me fit.
Yeah.
And I always think it gives me hope when things like that happen, because it's a horrible economy. It's a cruel, horrible, inhumane world in terms of the setup. The fuck is Sonic Bono, but you know what I mean? The minute we started wrapping up food, it became unfair, I suppose, if you think about it. But we have, what was I saying? What was my point?
Of the technology is developed
the fact
to come
that that's
to actually
righted
make
itself
us
a little
healthy.
Bit and it continues to. I always like to think sort of the fuck ups we make will right itself, whether it be like ruining the planet
I think that's what's weirdly happened as well with, this is going to sound so old man, but with the internet and social media and things like that, is we suddenly had this great connection tool and we used it for porn and slagging people off and being aggressive. And then you've seen now where there's media embargoes and news that can't get out in parts of the world and trash media and with agendas.
Yeah,
the fact is people can just talk openly and have that truth. And that's like, that's what it was for. That's what, like, you kind of remember, that's why we started this, to have this openness and freedom. Yeah. And podcasts are another one of them. I rave about it a lot, but not because I have one, but because I listen to 10 hours or so of podcasts a week because I love that freedom of talk and expression there.
And it's completely, because I think that it's interesting, because if you look at the various parts of the media that were apparently would be under attack from a digital era, which was the print newspapers, TV, and how people watched it and how you could create revenue streams from and all that, and radio. I don't think radio has. I think some radio suffered, and a lot of radio suffered from not moving with it.
Yeah, or, completely.
Or forgetting what the core value of radio is.
Yeah.
But it's also really exciting. I mean, we're sitting in a room at Talk Sport here that's not a studio. You just sat it up while we were talking, and off we go. I mean, I'm at the stage now where if I went to my boss at Talk Sport and said, look, I've decided I want to do my radio show from Hawaii from now on, or I want to do it from the Australian Outback, he would literally say to me, have you got cable TV? Can you watch the football and the sport from there? And I go, yeah, I'll sort that. And he'd go, are you picking up the costs? I bet, yep. And he goes, okay, well, I'll pay you 70% of what I'm paying you now.
Yeah.
So, because we need something back if I'm going to let you work from anywhere in the world. Yeah. And I go, yeah, I could do that tomorrow. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not brave enough to do it, but
TalkSport, and I want to get through your whole career, so we'll jump right back to the start shortly. But I think TalkSport's a great example of developing and moving with what people wanted, because there was a point where Talk had other stuff on there, or TalkSport had, it wasn't just people talk. Because I remember a message in you at one point when I'd got a new car and the radio actually worked. And before that, it didn't. I had a tape deck and that was it. Yeah. And the radio actually worked. And I was like, I've driven around constantly for 3 weeks and all I've listened to is you guys talking about sport. And part of it became a curiosity of, at what point am I going to get bored of people talking about it? And it didn't, it never came.
It never happened.
And that was the beauty of it, was there was a point where there was that incorrect thought of, oh, we need to diversify. Oh, we need to have this in there. We need to change the subject here and there. And then they kind of went, no, actually, if we have got the people who can talk about it that much, then there's the people out there who are just getting on with their day and having it on in their van or wherever else and need to, or van sounds very stereotypical talk sport.
It's interesting because we are, I mean, they say now that sort of 6 out of 10 people listen to talk sport of the same profile as 6 out of 10 people listen to Five Live and stuff like that. But the great thing about talk sport is, and listen, there's many negatives and there's many positives, and I think I've never worked anywhere that wasn't the same. I never will. And anyone listening to this in their job can do a list of negatives and a list of positives.
Of course.
But the greatest thing about this place is they have solidly just through, really, like, we've had the slot that I do, the 10 a.m. to 1 p.m, we broke the all-time ratings record at a time when radio was going to be diminishing. So since they turned on the signal here, we beat it. But we've also had lows. Like, our last rating was 300,000 lower.
Yeah.
But they just let me get on with the business of being creative and making 3 hours of radio that I feel is me.
Yeah.
And the only time they ever pull me in is they say, look, just remember who you are and remember what you're trying to do and continue to be the puppet master and getting the best out of people and doing what you do. You know, never feel like you need to do the big story all the time.
Yeah.
So that's really refreshing, you know. That's amazing. Actually, the BBC was the opposite. So that was very much more aimed at ratings.
But again, it's where I've always felt that you come into your own when it's exactly that situation. And what was great when I love Colin and Edith in the daytime. I thought that was great and I want to talk about that. But it seemed that when, similar with when I got my XFM show, I, partly influenced by your show, was like, I want as late as possible because I want as little restrictions on me as possible. I want to be able to do what I want to do. And that's what I feel on the Talk Sport show. And I was thinking on the way here, I was thinking, it's too much to say that it's even great if you're not into sport, because most of the time you need to be into sport. Yeah. But there's still a lot. I remember, I'm sure I messaged you at the time, but you had a guy, I can't remember his name, but it was the blind explorer guy.
Miles Hilton Barber.
It was honestly one of the best bits of radio I've ever heard in my life.
He sticks for me to today, you know.
It was absolutely stunning. It was like, right, this transcends lads talking about sport or people having a laugh in the studio. It's like, this was just a fascinating stuff.
They're the moments they're the moments that make radio special for me. Yeah. That's why I love it. And yeah, you have to go through sometimes, you know, other interviews that are a complete other end of the spectrum. Mm. But this guy was, you know, blind at 21, 22, described himself, quoting him, as a victim. He said, I thought I was a victim, didn't do anything to his 40s. And then all of a sudden he's flying around the world on his own, sailing around the world on his own, walking across the bed of the Dead Sea, pushing his mate in a wheelchair, you know, with a, and he's got his white stick. And he said in that interview, actually, he said, and it sounds a bit Hallmark, but it stuck with me. And he said, the only enemy of today is yesterday and tomorrow. And I thought, that's kind of like, he put into one line what I've been trying to develop as a philosophy for me. And I think it's absolutely true. I think it's the best little bit of just one little, you know, snippet of advice. If someone said to me, like, what is the one line you'd, you'd pass on that you've ever heard in any interview?
Yeah.
It would be that guy. It's interesting you pull him out. Cause
it's definitely opened up for me as well, because it's something that I've tried to then put out to people in another way, was where he kind of said, like, I look at what I want to do, and then I look at the reasons I can't do that.
Yeah.
And I break it down. And like this first one was with, I was flying a plane. He's like, why can't I? And then he's like, well, actually, 90% of plane flying this day is it's all reading meters and digital stuff. It's not actually my eyes looking.
No.
There's no pilot who's going, oh, we're going to have to turn left in a minute and looking out for a signpost. It's like, it's all digital. So it's like, so why can't I? I can develop something that makes it, that allow, that's audio, that tells me that I can then control. And that was a great thing on, again, I said this, I had Ed Skrein on the podcast. It was absolutely amazing. And he's got a mantra of why the fuck not.
Yeah.
And again, it's a similar thing. You can look at absolutely anything. And if you look at being an astronaut and you're in your 30s, then you can probably break it down and go, right, no, there's reasons I can't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's fine. But if you have to look at it first, like any time someone I know is like, oh, I can't do this, I'm like, can you give me the reasons?
Yeah.
Because if you've just said you can't because you don't think you can and not actually looked at the reasons, then it's wrong. You could be wrong. You could be really wrong.
There's always, maybe it's our part of the world that makes it different, but I always feel there's a sizable more amount of people telling you why you can't than why you can.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's a difficult one. And also when you do, you tend to be, it's a terrible thing that people do, and I do it as well, but somebody says, you know, I've just done this.
Yeah.
And you kind of think to yourself, I wonder, could I do that? And in a weird way, there's part of that's inspiring, but the other part of it is, the first thing you think about is, why did I not do it?
Yeah.
And that can create a little bit of a, like, people, when you do succeed at something, it can sometimes have a little bit of a vacuum negative effect.
Yeah, because everyone's looking around, going, well, that should be me.
That's it's interesting. It's an inherent thing, isn't it? You automatically think
it's finding that and making it motivational. I remember within a month or so seeing the Beastie Boys live and the Bloodhound Gang live, and both of them, completely different, but both of them, I sat there and thought, feasibly I could do that.
Yeah,
I'm not saying I could do it as good, but seeing one in the garage and one I think it was at Wembley, I was like, there's somewhere in this spectrum that I could exist.
I find the Beastie Boys, absolutely. I think Bloodhound Gang's a strange I can see why
it was weird, the Beastie Boys on the wings,
but I wasn't expecting the Bloodhound Gang at the other.
It's a shock.
I'm pretty sure you could have done what the Bloodhound Gang were doing at that exact moment with very little effort. Beastie Boys, I get, is something you'd aspire to be, but you know,
it's like, literally, I could finish this gig if something went wrong. But.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if he actually drops dead, the bass player, I could probably fucking do that.
Don't worry,
just by ear.
I've got this. But so let's talk about your kind of upbringing then. So growing up, were you in Belfast or just outside?
Yeah, it was, well, Belfast is kind of like a lot of villages put together.
Yeah.
At that time growing up, you very much stayed to your village as well. And this is the old Cinque Estates as well. So Belfast, sort of the further you went out, the more you get your estates. So each north, east, south, west all had their own council estates.
Yeah.
South less, actually, because that's a bit posh.
Right.
So I was East Belfast, so where my estate ran out, there was about a mile of greenfields, 2 miles of greenfields, and you're in Newtonards.
Yeah.
It's so right on the edge of Belfast.
With so much of Ireland in particular, and even now that you get to the edge of such built upness and it just stops.
Well,
and there's just flowing fields for so long. It's such a strange thing that we don't have as much in England. It seems in England you'll get to the edge and there'll be some really big nice houses, then some more nice houses, then it'll start to get into to countryside. But in Ireland, it seems so much as like it can be the most built up, and you'll cross a line, and there's barely a road anymore.
And that's such a shame. And the more like I go back now and look at where I spent the first 8-9 years of my life in this place called Ballybean Estate, and then we moved out, and then I moved back in when I was 16, just turned 16, until sort of moving out of there maybe at 19, 20. Yeah. And you know, I go back now and I still sort of try and drive through it once every year and a half, 2 years, and it's changed so much. The best thing is about them knocking down the blocks, you know, and the big council high rises. But still, you know, when we grew up there, yeah, I was saying this to someone the other day. I was doing an event at Stormont Castle for BBC Music Day, and I'm looking out, and some of the people who came over for that were saying, "So where did you grow up?" And I was like, "Right there." And they were like, "Well, where's the Shankill and the Foss?" I'm like, "That's just it there." And we could see everything, and they were like, "So you would have known all these?" And I was like, "No, I never ever went up there.
Yeah.
I never went anywhere near there.
Yeah.
I went to Tigers Bay once because I fancied a girl, and near got my head taken off. Yeah. And apart from that, I stayed where I was because we had the doctor's surgery, the supermarket, the football pitch, everything that we needed to be a community was in our own council estate and just in the streets outside. Yeah. That's where we went.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And, you know, it was, you know, well, from one point of it, you know, you got your new people and it was a sense of community. But the other side of it is it's an awful thing to separate people and say, look,
to put them that's all you need. You stay there.
It's social conditioning. It's really bad. It's when people complain about social housing, it really fucking frustrates me, you know, because the other option of that is to seclude people and put them all in one area in the outskirts of the town. And how's that different from what you do to, you know, what back in the day was said, well, you've got these diseases, we'll put you out there. And it's an economic version of that, isn't it? You're the generation before you didn't have a fucking chance. We're not going to give you one either.
It's a weird one because when I was at school, I'd have the piss taken a little bit because my town hasn't got a cinema or any clubs or anything. It's got pubs and takeaways, essentially. Yeah. That's all it's got. But that meant that from an early age, I would go to other towns. Mm. If I wanted to go out, I'd need to go to Basildon or Southend or Romford. And these aren't idyllic places to go to, but at least it's not just staying in my own place. And that was the thing with everyone else, you realise, because you had, again, not this huge range, but just enough. Just enough to make you not leave your 5 mile radius or 10 mile radius. It's like, that's not a good thing.
Well, as a kid, that's where you form your prejudices and that's where you form your suspicions and your fears.
Yeah, completely.
That, of course, these days are fed a lot more by media. But as you say, we're breaking out of that a bit. But it's certainly not then. You didn't. That was very much fueled by.
Yeah.
That was a non-internet world.
Of course.
So fear and suspicion was quite easy to build up in people. You know.
So how big were? Because the two things that have formed your life essentially are music and sport.
Yeah.
So how big were music and sport when you were growing up at school? How was it at school? Was there a lot of people into music or was
the two very different things. So sport was very
such a weird thing is the way you've gone into both when they're such different worlds. You don't.
I love the competition, so I can go through my entire life as a child and quote sport. So the 86 World Cup, last time Northern Ireland qualified for a major tournament until the Euros, which I go tomorrow. It's like, I can't believe I packed this morning, put my Northern Ireland flag inside my bag, put my tops, put my scarf. That's, and it's like, so my God, it brought me back to when I was at Kevin's birthday party and my mum wouldn't let me go home to watch, I think it was the Brazil game, and like when we played Brazil and we get fucking hammered, and like, I remember crying so much, and then she let me go and watch it, you know.
Is there a weird pleasure that there's been that much of a gap since they were last in it, and you get to go now? It's they've waited long enough for you to get to the point where you can be there representing and covering this.
Let me tell you, I'd rather we'd have qualified since, but now it's here. It gives you a brilliant fake badge of honour. You can wear with any England fan can page and say, well, hold on a second. Let me tell you what suffering is.
Yeah.
But the sport was very much me. Then I didn't realise at the time, but like, I was fascinated with the rules of sport. So even when I was like 6, 7, people would say to me, how does that work? And I'd be like, well, it goes 15 love, 30 love, 40 love, and it'll reduce at 40, and then you need an advantage, and you have 6 games or 7-5 or a tie break. And I just love the rules of sport to this day. You know, I used to watch grandstand from that was my Saturday. And I didn't want to do anything else. And you know, so when I was a kid, I was watching Bracknell play ice hockey
over the rules and the
horse racing and everything about how long's a furlong. And and I didn't realise that that was how my mind worked back then. I'm acutely aware of it now that it's mathematical and it's nerdy and it's that's what it is. And it's very kind of like you know, it is on the spectrum the way I think. I get that now, but at the time I didn't realise.
Yeah.
And I just loved and craved competition. And I would watch, you know, whether it was Khan playing squash or Becker when he broke through at Wimbledon. I have these huge memories of all of this.
Yeah.
I remember West Tip winning the fucking Grand National.
Yeah.
Like, I just remember all of these moments. I remember tops, like the blue with the stripe. I remember Dunwoody. I remember, and it all sticks. And so I've always had a fascination with sport that's competitive rather than, not necessarily the top, but just competitive sport and what and everything with it.
Yeah.
So that was me.
Yeah.
Music was very much the family, my mum.
Yeah.
So she was a sorry, my nose is running, I get terrible cold. Yeah. My mum was a hippie chick growing up. She was born in the very early 50s. And my grandfather's a different story altogether. He's kind of like hero of my life.
Yeah.
Was in what I thought was the army, which I've since found out was MI6.
Right. Wow.
And he travelled the world. So they lived everywhere.
Yeah.
And my mum was actually dragged off a plane in Singapore trying to run away to Woodstock.
Wow.
So I wouldn't have been born had she not have been dragged off that plane.
Wow.
But I think now I realise when your grandfather was in MI6, there was a good chance he was going to find out, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we got this fantastic musical history. So when I remember very well, there was the sport on the TV for me, but outside of that, I mean, I can't remember watching many programmes growing up. And to this day, I will watch box sets, and that is, again, that side of the way my brain works. I obsess. And I go, bum, 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 but I'm not...
To get through this
and that's brought me back to TV a lot more, but... we had this record player, which was fantastic. It was the only thing in the house that was like, you know, don't put your jammy fingers in this or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we just had records, you know. My stepfather moved in, it doubled as well. And he liked all stuff that my mum didn't. So my mum tells me the first line I ever said as a human being, a full sentence, was, "I come down from the misty mountain, I got lost on the human highway."
Oh, wow.
It still, you know, chokes me up. It's a it's a Neil Young album.
Yeah.
Comes a Time was still one of my favourite albums of all time. Brilliant acoustic Neil Young album. Four Strong Winds is on it. And Human Highway is still one of my favourite songs. But I was obsessed with that record. And I remember flicking through all my childhood years, you know, and whether it be my stepdad bringing in stuff like Springsteen, which I hadn't heard, Supertramp and all this nonsense, Jeff Blinn's, War of the Worlds. We had that Gatefold album, Two Low for Zero, Elton John, Dylan Records. There used to be this guy came round my house called the Carrot Man. Sounds sinister, doesn't it? But they were the friends of my mum. And I look back now and realise that we're all getting stoned in the living room.
Yeah.
But I didn't know when I was a kid. He used to have this carrot with a hole in it round his neck. And now looking back, like, he was obviously smoking dope.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Proper hippies. So
That's amazing, the band,
the Carrot Man. And the guy, right, and I tell you what, funny enough, talking about people, and this sounds sinister, but it's not. There was this fantastic guy in our estate called Mr. Curry, an old, really old guy, Scottish guy. And he used to have Ludo and chess, and he taught us these mind game playing games. And he was a huge Liverpool fan. And I think he came from roughly the same part of the world as Shankly. And he turned every kid in our area into a Liverpool fan.
Liverpool fans,
my stepdad was Spurs. So he was like, "You gotta be Spurs, you gotta be Spurs." My next door neighbors were all Glentoran, a local team. And this, he used to sit us down and he'd say, "I'll tell you about the day that Bill Shankly invented five-a-side football." So we were all Liverpool fans. Everyone was from this kid. And he changed everyone in that area. And the idea now of an old man taking all the kids into his house, telling stories and playing games. But he was just sensational. And then that was going on. Musically, it was just there all the time, you know, non-stop. And I didn't realise then how much music I was listening to.
Yeah.
But the Beatles were the ahead of that list. So my mum was just absolutely fascinated by the Beatles. And I also listened to a lot of shit, as you do when you're a kid.
I mean,
my first records were The Wombles and Madness. I remember getting Agadoo Black Lace and 7-inch and being the most popular kid for the first time ever, playing it out the window and everyone doing the things.
Yeah.
You know, there's no room for, I think, guilty pleasures and all that.
I find it far more comfortable
when people haven't got that credible first record. Listen, or first, it's like, come on.
But because they're lying anyway.
It's not how it's meant. Even if they're not lying, I feel sorry for you because you've not enjoyed the ludicrousness of just stupid music.
There's only one thing worse than someone who lies about their first record, and that's the person who comes to like a house party and puts a Nick Drake album on. And I'm like, dude, I like Nick Drake, but this makes you a wanker. You know, just because you put that on, it doesn't make you a good guy.
I've had people at my club night before. I had this one guy just stand there next to the decks as I'm DJing, and he just called me. I was like, what happened, man? Mm-hmm. I was like, what? He was like, I listen to your music, I listen to your radio show. Why are you playing this shit? I was like, oh, because we're in a club.
Yeah.
It's like we're in a club. I'm playing like club hip hop. And also, because I'm a bit drunk, I want to hear M.O.P. And I want to hear rowdy hip hop. I don't want to hear my music or say Sage Francis or people that I absolutely adore. It's like, there's a time and a place for these things.
I DJ in an indie, a really like ultra underground indie club with Pat Nevin, the footballer Pat Nevin. And he loves his indie music. And I joked on the way down. I said, last track of the night, ELO, Mr. Blue Sky.
Yeah.
And he burst out laughing. I said, I don't know what you're laughing about. I'll teach you a lesson. And then we put it on last track of the night, and the place went mental.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, don't pigeonhole people ever.
Yeah, completely.
And so at 16th birthday, what am I going to get from a 16th birthday? It was very fractious. That I was a terrible kid. Not an evil kid, just a terrible kid. Hyperactive.
Right.
Always in trouble, suspended, expelled. Right. I was kicked out of a grammar school. I was kicked out of my high school.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't even
always go. For just acting up, right?
I used humour as a way to cozy up to... And you got to remember, not playing that card, but the era I grew up in and where I grew up, you know, people weren't just... bad boys in that they had catapults in the back pocket and were putting people's pigtails. You know, it was genuine trouble between young wings of paramilitary organisations.
Yes,
and,
of course.
And that's your day was like that. You went to school with people who would go on, you know, doctorates, dole queues, jail cells, all sorts of amazing things. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, very intelligent people, articulate people. And there was a very rough side to growing up where I grew up.
Of course.
So I used class clown and humour to cozy up to all of those people.
Yeah.
I think I had like two or three fights in my old childhood, right through 16, and ran away, I think, from two out of three of those. And, like, I was never, you know, and all I did was talk shit to get out of trouble. So I knew the bad boys, and I was there performing monkey, and I knew I think I had enough of a brain to also get on with the decent, the other people. That was my whole childhood, was that.
Just walking that line.
Walking that line, which I think helps in the chameleon that sometimes you need on radio to switch quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've always kind of had it quite naturally. But when I was 16, I come down the stairs, and it wasn't during the greatest time. I was moving back into the council estate as soon as I turned 16 to live with my mate Scott, you know, and that was it. My mum just bought me, and you know, at a time when things were quite fractious, I came in, it was just a balloon that said happy birthday, and there was an album without a cover on it, and I had no idea how, because I'd been through the whole early rave scene.
Right.
So, because I was born in 77, so I was, it went through the whole generation of...
Yeah.
I started drinking very, very young. So we go down the park with carryouts and listen to mixtapes and Joey Beltram, and you discover all this amazing, fantastic music. And now I look back and I think it's amazing. But 16th birthday, my mum bought me on CD the White Album, and it was this white cover, and that was it.
Yeah.
That album for me, again, just reconnected me with, I think, what I was much more into before I became quite a bad lad.
Yeah.
So that's probably the single most important thing that anyone's ever got
musical
me
intervention,
which makes me such a fucking hypocrite, because I don't want anything for my birthday. So there you go. How fucking hypocritical is that?
So where did so when did you start to get into journalism as such? And because I believe you came into journalism, and then that's I mean, it's crazy, your first proper radio gig essentially was Radio 1, right?
Which radio gig. I did a bit of student radio for one show, and they
obviously
kicked me
off. That's what everyone is said to be working towards.
Very bizarre how it happened.
I had Hugh Stevens on, who was a similar one at 16.
He's same working time as me,
At the same time, it's like...
Well, I was the second youngest ever Radio 1 DJ. He was the first on the same day.
Fucking Hugh.
So, because he got fucking bastard. Funny, I bumped into him in a Mannix gig the other week, and just he sat in front of me, loved the guy so much.
Yeah.
And he got, on the day that he started at Radio 1, I think he's 6 months younger than me or something like that, he got his A-level results, and he got BBC. What are their chances? That is amazing. I always remember that.
That is amazing. I love
but
that.
Listen, I always loved the. I never seen myself as a radio DJ ever or a TV presenter ever. And I was never told I could be that.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things. No one ever said to me, you talk too much. Yeah. Why don't you go into that? And that's one of the real crying shames for me is that it's not seen to this day as a viable career.
I had Michael Smiley on.
I
had Michael Smiley on, and he was saying how it was years and years, and it wasn't until he came to London. So it's an odd thing, actually. Growing up in Northern Ireland, he was saying, in that situation, no one ever said, oh, you're funny, you should do stand-up. Never. He was just funny, or you're good. Yeah. It wasn't until he was in London that someone went, you know you can do that for a career.
I know, what, like, he'd been told. He'd been told to get a trade. So,
what do you mean? Yeah, exactly. And it was fascinating to hear that he was like, he'd been doing this whole life. Yeah. Then someone said, you can be paid to do that. And he wrote for radio first and stuff like that.
That's
and then
exactly
was like, oh,
it. That's exactly it. Journalism was different for me. I always was only really attentive if I was reading something or watching something. Yeah. That would kind of pull me in, if it pulled me in.
Yeah.
And I think I liked the world I could go into when I was reading. So I always had a love of it. So, like, even at 5 or 6, I sort of would talk about being a newspaper boy or whatever. Yeah. Not quite knowing the terminology and being very scatty. I had speech therapy, so I couldn't get my words the right way around. So I had to go at, like, 3. My mum would know better, but I think 2, 3, and 4 before I could get my sentence. I was like Yoda.
Yeah.
I would talk backwards.
Brilliant.
Exactly. So it wasn't the fucking internet era then, right?
Yeah.
My mum would have all these embarrassing MP3s and fucking clips. So I had this teacher when I was about 12, 13. It would have been 13. And through the last 2 years of school and almost a lot, I get kicked out just before my GCSEs. But she was called Mrs. Piper, and I had her on a Radio 1 show at some stage when you were asked to bring the person on that, you know.
Wow.
And she was the first person ever said to me, she went, yeah, of course you can be a writer if you want to be a writer. We were reading, she took English and English literature.
Yeah.
And I used to have this thing where I knew I could ask her a question at the start of the class. And if it was a good enough question, everyone would get off having to work.
Yeah.
So that people would always say, because she loved talking, and they'd go to me, ask her a question. And I'd be like, Mrs. Piper, this Sean O'Casey playing the stars, do you think, and that would be it. Boom, job done. Everyone would be sitting, smoking, and, you know.
People know that with me on Twitter with MMA. Like when people all, there was a point where people on Twitter would try and say something offensive to get an answer. People now know, if you ask me anything about a UFC or mixed martial arts, it's going to get a long response. I'll just be drawn in like, oh shit, yeah, actually this happened and then this and then this. It's
just
exactly
had a first
like
British champion, haven't we?
All last night. We're recording this now. I was up till 7 a.m. watching that last night. And then
Bisping, is that how you pronounce his name?
Bisping. It was, I mean, it was one of the most amazing nights of sport I've seen.
And the guy beat him, didn't he? He'd been beaten by that guy not long ago, and then but he thumped them in like a minute and a half.
And the fact is that Bisping, I'm British, I've watched Bisping for a long time, I didn't think he would ever be champ. Yeah. And the fact is he was being beaten up, and then he just, it's the beauty of that sport of you can never bet, like you can never know who's going to win. And the fact is that card had some of the biggest wins this year in the sport, but the first fight on the prelim, on the unaired prelim that was on online only, one fight of the night. And that's the beauty of that sport,
that's
is
fantastic.
Anyone, like it's two guys in there pitting themselves against each other. It could be anyone. That
come back to MMA with me, because it's funny, because it's interesting, there'll be people listening to this now who will say, oh, I don't watch it, it's a barbaric sport. And I want to give a counter argument to that in a second, but this may be the two people that go off in more tangents than any two people ever talk to each other. But it's like a really bad fast show sketch, isn't
I'm
it?
I'm trying we to make notes like of where we come back.
So this teacher, Mrs. Piper, said you can write, and she believed in me, and she embraced the side of me that was distracted, because she realised, I think she realised anyway, there was a creativity there.
Yeah.
And so she kind of validated my kind of love for the written word, and that's all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get a break anywhere, and I didn't deserve it, really, to be fair. I mean, it wasn't like I get like 4 GCSEs, and it was the English literature, maths, history, that was it.
Yeah.
I didn't like anything else, so I was, you know, disrupted in those classes. And I was going to go, I randomly liked Latin and gardening, and landscape gardening was on the radar a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was accepted into a college to go and do at 16 to go there and study agriculture and horticulture, because you believe that. And from nowhere, the Ulster Newsletter accepted me in a YTP scheme, $29.50 a week. I'd already bought the boots to go to the college. I'd given up any hope that I thought I could do journalism. And they took me in. And it was maybe one of those last eras where the CV wasn't important. You know, they'd give me press releases to write, and I'd write them. And one might make the paper every week. And I just worked my balls off.
Yeah.
I was in there 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then I worked 4 to 5 shifts a week in McDonald's to make my money up. And I was there for 2 years. And that was my apprenticeship, 16, 18. And very early on, it was interesting. They would send me to things where, say, the cameraman was taking pictures and they needed one paragraph written.
Yeah.
You know, double page spread on. So there was the Queen's University graduations. They were printing a double page spread of pictures of the new graduated students from Queen's University. Go along, young junior, with your flappy shoe and your terrible fucking school trousers with a hole in them. Go up there and take the names of the people who are in the pictures. That is your job.
Easy.
And write a paragraph and that's it. And I came back and I'm writing it. And there's this guy, I remember his name, Stephen Moore, sitting beside me. And he said, how was it? I said, it was fine. And then he said to him, you know, it was a bit weird though. There was no national anthem. I always thought they had a national. And he went, what? I went, oh, there was no national anthem. And continued to write. And he went, wait there. And he went up to the news editor and he went, they've ditched the Queen, God Save the Queen, from Queen's University. And the shit hit the fan. So here I was as a kid at 16 with a front page byline. And I've got it framed to this day. The Queen faces the axe. And that was my front page byline. It was this wonderful, fortuitous moment that this guy, Stephen Moore, spotted. Because I would never have known to write it. And
again, it goes exactly back to what you were saying about when I was saying on the Olympics of watch it. Oh, he had a white t-shirt on. It's finding those things that you'd see as throwaways. Like, oh, they didn't do the national anthem. That was weird. It's like, it's that's totally a story.
I didn't have the ability to spot it, but I had the work ethic to notice it and 100%. To write everything down. And, you know, I've always said ever since, I'm always like, I always keep my eye on what I'm doing and do it as best as I can. And anything that's any money or success, quote unquote, that comes from that is a byproduct.
Yeah.
The minute you look at that, say goodbye.
Yeah.
Say goodbye to it. The more you try and grab it, it's like the amount that people spend their time on IMDb and Twitter and charts and forums and see what people think about them.
Yeah.
It's like, just write another fucking song. Just write another article. Just, you know, take care of that and everything else will take care of itself.
100%. But
that's how I got in. That was the start. And I only ever wanted to write. And then there was a few moments, one in particular, which was just... not to sound arrogant, but I think quite early they started to trust me as a... I wasn't getting paid as a reporter, but they trusted me with stories. And I think a good sign of that would be, you know, that sort of evidence of that would be on the anniversary of the Shankill bombing, they sent me to... No, first of all, I was at that funeral. So when the Shankill bombing happened, that was when I was doing my apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And they sent me, and this kid called Leanne died, and... anyway, they sent me up to this funeral and then the next funeral and the next funeral. And I went with this female reporter and shadowed her. I wasn't writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that stayed with me that I didn't want that for a career.
Yeah.
I didn't want that because I'm not the person who can leave that at home.
Yeah.
I'll leave that at work. So I was like, this is definitely not.
This isn't the one.
I know this is not a part of journalism that I don't want to do.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel like anything other than, you know, emotional scarring. I'm not the person. I mean, there's a lot of people can, and I have such respect for them.
100%.
But I fail in that level. I can't leave things at home, at work. And then I covered a story where I went up to interview the kids at two schools, one Catholic, one Protestant, a year or two. I think it was a year after this kid Leanne had been killed in the Shankill bombing. And I interviewed the kids, and I remember writing a piece. And again, I just thought, this is, I can't see this being something that wouldn't absolutely, you know, drain me. And so I switched to writing about music because that was the thing that I think I knew best.
I was gonna say it makes sense of your career then, because everything you seem to work in is stuff that you don't want to leave at work.
Yeah.
You know, making it your job gives you the right to obsess over football, obsess over music, and obsess over these things that some people at other points say, you've watched 4 matches already this weekend. You can't, and you're like, It's my job. I can justify it my job. It allows that obsession.
I just cannot. For me, I felt that quite a lot covering that, and yeah. and I said, look, I can't see this being in my head. I was like, I can't see me sitting in 20-30 years, and I've seen some of the journalists in there and what they yeah. went through in that time. And in fact, it was a real, not a problem, because there's no problem comes with a cessation of violence, but there was almost like a retraining of journalists after right. the Good Friday Agreement, because yeah. so many had spent all their time every day kneecappings, bombings, punishment yeah. beatings, protection rackets, drugs rings, and it was what they covered. You know, it's what the papers were full of. And all of a sudden it was like, well, now we're going to be talking about education more, and we're going to be talking about policies and new government. And there was a whole different change in media. But again, that's another tangent. But I switched into writing about music. Yeah. And I remember my first interview was, I think, 2 interviews in a week on the phone, which was Hadaway.
Amazing.
And E17 phone interviews.
Amazing.
And before that, of course, I'd done that Cindy Crawford thing.
Yeah.
But, and from then, I met a guy called Paul McNamee at a launch of some festival.
Yeah.
And it was such a sterile thing. Yeah. And he was there for one newspaper or whatever. I was there for the Ulster Newsletter, or maybe even the Sunday People at that time. And we went over the road, and I went, you were at the thing. We started talking, and we just hit it off. And the only magazines you could buy that were Northern Ireland based were advertorial bullshit, nonsense magazines, in my opinion, you know. And there was no real vibrant local music. There used to be one called Deviate, and that had went bust. And me and this guy just hit it off, and we went, let's do something different. And we under a veil of excess and drunkenness and the headiness that comes with being in your late teens, we started a magazine called Blank. And it was, I have no fucking idea how it ever got published.
Again, it's that thing of turning your passions or enjoyment into your work.
Yeah, always people, came with that, people, yeah.
The word obsession or addiction even, they're dark and horrible words, but yeah. I think there is some worth in, if you can find something good to put your addictions into or your addictive personality into. And the fact is, I obsess over music or MMA or all these different things. So if you can make them your work, then the fact that you live, sleep and breathe them can become a positive thing.
And if my wife was here, she would say, and a negative thing. I just imagine if the third might hear, she'd be like, you two, stop a second and think outside of that. But
speaking of which, as we're at the hour mark, and there is a load more I want to talk about, I'm going to stop here and start a part two. Again, we won't be going for hours. I'll let you go home. I'm not going to...
No, I'm all good. I've got a dinner with
you're not going to miss the Euros.
Got a dinner with my wife in an hour.
Perfect.
An hour and 20 minutes.
Exactly. Well, that's perfect. we'll go on to part two. So I'll pause that there, because I want to talk about a Radio 1. I want to talk about the inadverted impact that you and I had on spoken word, which I didn't realise until years later. But we'll get on to that. So, sure. Yeah.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. How lovely was that? What a lovely gent. I'm going to wrap up real quick here, because we need to get on to the next one, because you're going to enjoy it. Please subscribe if you're new to this, and click subscribe or auto-download or any of them things. It all means a lot. And rate us, all those kind of things that you can do for free. Obviously, you can buy stuff in the web store at speechdevelopmentirecords.com, but all of those support things you can do for free. So if you can do that, it really helps. So thank you very much, and on to the next one.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.